I've been personally opposed to the death penalty, like I would hope all good judges do, and I think I was a good judge. You have to set aside your personal opinion and follow the law, and there's a federal death penalty law, and so I felt an obligation to faithfully follow the law. It was the jury that decided whether he should live or die, but once the jury decided that the death penalty was appropriate on both post-verdict and post-trial motions, I affirmed not only his finding of guilt, but the finding of the jury that he should be sentenced to death. And so as long as there's a valid federal law, you know, the federal law should be applied fairly. And I have no personal or professional qualms or reservations about Dustin Hawken being executed. You know, I was a sitting district court judge for 24 years, and I handled criminal cases in five different districts, including 500 down in the District of Arizona. And Dustin Hawken is the most evil person, in my view, that I've ever met in my life. He killed five people, and I think it's appropriate, given the jury verdict and the fair trial that he received and all of the judges that reviewed the various appeals. His appeals are over, and it's appropriate that he be executed.
But his case, it was just so sad. I mean, obviously, the federal government decided that since this was a crime that involved children, that's why this execution is going to happen.
Yes, I think had the crime not involved two children, Candy and Amber Duncan, they were ages 6 and I believe 10 at the time of their death. I'm not sure that the Justice Department would have sought the death penalty. But with the children, it made, I thought, a pretty easy decision. That and the multiple murders. And the fact that he was trying to silence witnesses that were scheduled to testify against him. You had all those factors together, and it clearly made for a federal death penalty case.
And in his case, there was also another defendant who was originally sentenced to death, but you changed that sentence in that case.
Yes, and that was based on completely different legal issue and a different set of facts. I mean, the facts involving the five murders were essentially the same. But I found in Angela Johnson, the co-defendant's case, that there was ineffective assistance of counsel because the defense team wasn't very well coordinated. They were really good lawyers, but for some reason they didn't mesh well. They weren't coordinated. And there was substantial evidence about her organic brain syndrome, as I recall, and psychological and most importantly, neuropsychological evidence that the defense was alerted to, but they never followed up on. And so we had a very lengthy, I think it took 18 or 19 days spread out over a year, 50 some witnesses. And after I heard all the testimony, I decided that she did not receive constitutionally protected effective assistance of counsel. And so I set aside the penalty phase, in other words, the jury finding of the death penalty, but I did not set aside the guilt finding because the evidence was overwhelming. And no matter who the lawyers were, it wouldn't have made any difference. In other words, there was really no argument that she was not guilty. The only question was, should she receive the death penalty? And of course, the government had a right to appeal my decision when I set aside the death penalty, and they initially did, but then they withdrew it, and I sentenced her to life imprisonment.
You served on the federal bench for, gosh, a quarter of a century or so. Is this,
yes,
is this a case that you think about quite a bit? I'm assuming it made great impact on your career.
Well, it is because, you know, the cases, the two cases together consumed thousands and thousands of hours of my time over a span of, you know, 7, 8, 9 years, something like that, before, in terms of all the proceedings that I was involved in. hundreds of cutting-edge federal death penalty issues that I had to rule on, because both the prosecution, which was superb, the chief prosecutor, C.J. Williams, is now a United States District Court judge in the Northern District of Iowa over in Cedar Rapids, and the defense lawyers were, for the most part, excellent, particularly in Mr. Honkin's case. And so, you know, it just consumed an unbelievable amount of time and energy and resources. And so, I mean, they were very complicated cases. I added it up one time. I think I published over 1,200 pages of judicial opinions dealing with all the various issues that were raised in the two cases.
And you actually had planned on being there, but then the pandemic hit.
Yes, I had planned on attending. I received permission from the Bureau of Prisons to attend Dustin Honkin's execution, but you know, COVID-19 is a problem not only at the federal prison at Terre Haute, but they brought in numbers of officials from the Bureau of Prisons and the Department of Justice to supervise the imposition of the death penalty for the, I think, three men who are going to be executed this week at Terre Haute. And they couldn't guarantee that those folks did not have COVID-19. And the room that I was going to be in to view the execution is a very, very small room. And they rightfully reserved the larger room for members of the press and the members of the victims' families and any family members of Dustin Honkin that decided to attend. So the bottom line was I didn't want to be Honkin's sixth murder victim. So I wasn't willing to take the chance of catching COVID-19.
Now, I know in your work as a judge, there's been cases where you've met with people before who you've sentenced or you presided over their case. Did you ever have any kind of correspondence with Dustin Honkin? Did he ever reach out to you after the case? Or did you ever try to contact him at all?
No, he never reached out to me that I recall, and I made no effort to contact him because, you know, for many years after the his imposition of the death penalty, he had appeals pending. And so I didn't think it would be appropriate, and nor did I have any desire to reach out to him.
You were talking about, like, you said he's the most vile person. And I know during the whole case, security was so high because of, you know, just the nature of his crime. Did you ever feel unsafe when you were presiding over his trial?
I never felt unsafe because we had tremendous United States Marshals, and they brought in United States Marshals, deputy marshals from all over the country to assist with security. I mean, the U.S. Marshals determined that he was a very high risk, high threat defendant. So we had extraordinary security. They had a special team that guarded him 24 hours a day at the Woodbury County Jail where he was being held because there's no federal facility. And when he had been in there previously on a case that I had sentenced him to 27 years in prison, I think 3 years before he was indicted on the capital murder charges, he had made a couple different escape attempts. So there was tremendous security. He had also threatened to kill virtually everybody connected with the case. And I'm not sure many people know this. I can talk about it now, but we had a special hearing on security where he was present and his lawyers were present. And after hearing a lot of evidence, I ordered that he be bolted to the floor. And so he was bolted to the floor. We put a titanium bolt into concrete. And every morning before the jurors came to the courthouse, the U.S. Marshals would bring him in. And he was literally bolted to the floor. He had enough room where he could stand up. They put special tape on the bolt and on his leg irons so that it wouldn't make any noise. And they also put non-reflective tape because, as you know, the courtroom has a lot of windows and there's a lot of sunlight. And we wanted to make sure that nobody knew that he was bolted to the floor. We had special curtains made or skirts, really, for all the tables in the courtroom. And so those hid the fact that he was bolted to the floor. He was also deemed so dangerous that I ordered that he wear a stun vest at all times when he was in the courtroom. So a U.S. Marshal, the identity which was not revealed to me, always had a control device that could shock Dustin Honkin and literally bring him to his knees should it be necessary. It wasn't necessary. But I deemed it necessary because when he wasn't bolted to the floor and he was brought in and out of the courtroom, there was always a possibility of this attempted escape. And so he, you know, was both bolted to the floor and he had the stun vest.
Wow. Is there anything else you want people to know?
Well, you know, I know that the death penalty is very controversial, and I respect people's opinions on both sides. And I just want them to know that I did my best in Dustin Honkin's case to ensure that he got a very fair trial. And because of that, I don't really have any qualms whatsoever about the death penalty being imposed. You know, in federal court, in particular in Dustin Honkin's case, he had every advantage. You know, he had an extra lawyer appointed. I only had to appoint two, but I appointed three. I approved every expert witness the defense asked for. And we took extraordinary care in jury selection, extraordinary care to not let the jurors know about the extra security. And so I feel really good about the fact that I think he received a super fair trial. And so with that, you know, I'm not going to lose any sleep over his execution. But I understand some people are, you know, opposed to the death penalty in all respects. And I understand that. And I think others are in favor of it. I think the thing to remember is that there are now only, I think, well, after Mr. Lee was executed this week, I think there are 61 people on federal death row, right around there. I think there are 6,000 or 7,000 on death row in the various states that have the death penalty. And the states do not provide the type of procedural safeguards that Mr. Honkin received. So there are examples in state court of, you know, lawyers sleeping through part of the capital murder cases and being drunk and only being paid $5,000 for the whole case. And so, you know, a lot of the states, they don't really do enough to protect the rights of the accused. But in federal court, Mr. Honkin's constitutional rights were, in my view, fully protected. And so I think that makes it a big difference